Understanding is that Mr. Strauss will go first, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And split your time with Mr. Weidrich, is that how you say it? Weidrich, thank you. Okay. Proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning again, Your Honors. I represent Mr. Saylor, and this is 18-793, and this is another State Court Claims, State Tort Claims Act case. And in this case, Mr. Saylor filed claims under the State Tort Claims Act, filled out the forms that were just discussed in the other matter. And in this case, he, after filing his claims and those being denied, filed a federal case. And eventually, the federal court dismissed some, but not all, of those claims. And following the dismissal of the remaining claims, Mr. Saylor, within the six-month time frame from that dismissal, filed his state court litigation, his complaint. Now, that was eventually dismissed in this case, and it was dismissed based on his failure to file within the 6 months of the board's final disposition letter.
It was actually dismissed twice, wasn't it, by the state court?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
And what do you make of the first one?
All right, so the first dismissal was interesting because it occurred while the case was in federal court. The case was removed to federal court by the state. And during that time, it seems that there was some confusion, I think, maybe perhaps on the part of the court, on the part of the parties. Certainly, Mr. Saylor's counsel at the time, he failed to appear for a hearing because he believed that the removal to federal court meant that the state court would not be addressing his he'd filed a motion to alter or amend. That was filed in response to the state dismissing, or excuse me, the court dismissing based on failure to serve within the time period for service. Now, he missed that because the state, the same day he filed his motion to alter or amend, the state filed the removal to federal district court. He didn't show up. Later on, the court actually granted then, somewhat strangely, the court sua sponte entered a dismissal order at that time, even though the case at that point had been removed to federal court. So with respect to that, Your Honor, we're arguing that that was done without jurisdiction based on the removal to federal court.
Should it have been suspended?
Yes, jurisdiction was suspended at that time.
When the case was eventually remanded back from the federal court, and the state filed the motion to dismiss, and the matter was taken up again, does that give us some indication that the court set aside its own prior dismissal by ruling on the merits once it was back in front of the state court?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that, and I believe that can be implied.
Thank you.
I don't have a case for you on that, but I know that that implication of that essentially, I don't know if you would call it, this court would call it a granting of my client's motion to alter or amend, or whether it's simply another sua sponte reinstatement.
Court can set aside an order, can't it?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And I think you're right. I think that's exactly what it did. And that got us now to the point where we had to discuss what the state did, which was the state asked it to be dismissed based on the failure to comply with the six-month statute of limitations over STCA claims, the State Tort Claims Act claims. That's what eventually was used to dismiss my client's amended complaint. And that's what we're here, you know, and that is the subject of assignment of error 2 in our brief. And ultimately, assignment of error 2 in our brief, we're asking the court to examine whether the savings clause reaches the amended complaint filed by Mr. Saylor.
In federal court?
Yes. Well, it was initially filed in federal court and then eventually filed in state court. And what we're arguing is that the filing in federal court, even though some of the claims were eventually found to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, according to the federal district court, that that determination does not amount to inaction on the part of Mr. Saylor. And ultimately, that's what the district court, in this state district court,
found. The federal lawsuit was filed before the claims were filed, is that right?
Yeah, before the state,
state
I think that's
claims
correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Were filed later than the federal lawsuit was filed.
Yes, Your Honor.
Federal lawsuits filed first, state claims are filed later, and then there's an amended federal complaint filed. So you're alleging that the amended federal complaint is the tolling factor?
Your Honor, we're asking the court to determine, we believe, and we're asking the court to find that the entirety of the federal litigation tolled.
How can the filing of the federal toll anything that hasn't happened yet? The federal lawsuit's filed before the claims are filed. How can that toll the claims?
Well, the State Tort Claims Act has the six-month requirement.
After denial or after filing, is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So you have to file the claim before you get the tolling.
That's correct.
So if the federal lawsuit was filed before the claims are filed, I mean, isn't it? What's it tolling?
Your Honor, if I could refer to this, and I apologize, there's quite a litany of different filings here, that it is hard to keep track of. I believe what the crux of our argument is that any time that was taken during for my client to file his 6 month file his state court claims in state court was told by either the initial filing in federal court, if not by the amended filing in federal court, which you referenced. And then during that time, he was in compliance with anything the federal court was asking him to do, any progression orders or anything of that nature. He didn't allow that complaint to simply lapse. He did litigate it actively.
In federal court.
Correct. And so what we're arguing is that the state district court's finding that it needed to be dismissed due to inaction, essentially, on Mr. Saylor's part, that the savings clause didn't apply due to inaction, that we're arguing that finding was incorrect, that the court misapplied the law in that respect.
So it's the amended federal law.
Yes, and I do apologize. I think I got the two mixed up.
Okay.
If there's any other questions, if there are any other questions, Your Honor, I'll save these last 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. As the court noted, there are several appellees in this case. I represent the state of Nebraska, as well as the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services, and my colleague, Mr. Weidrich, represents Correct Care Solutions. First, I would like to bring to the court's attention a statute in a case that was not previously briefed upon, that after further research, I believe is actually positive in this case. The statute is section 81-8227, subsection 5.
That's 8,227?
Yep, 8,227, subsection 5. And the case is Brodeen v. Blue Cross Blue Shield of Nebraska. The citation is 272 Nebraska 713. And that was from 2006. Now, section 81-8,227, subsection 5, is part of the State Tort Claims Act, which provides for its own statute of limitations. Now, subsection 5 of that specifically states, this section and section 25-13, which is another tolling statute, shall constitute the only statutes of limitations applicable to the State Tort Claims Act. So this statute, by its own terms, disallows the savings clause of Section 25-201.01 from applying to any suit within the State Tort Claims Act, which includes Mr. Saylor's. In fact, if the legislature had intended for the savings clause in 25-201.01, it could have absolutely put it in subsection 5, just as it did with the other tolling statute of 25-213. But it didn't. And the savings clause of 25-201.01 just doesn't apply to the State Tort Claims Act. Now, with regard to the case, Brodeen v. Blue Cross Blue Shield, now, Brodeen demonstrates that even outside of the State Tort Claims context, filing a case in federal court does not toll the applicable limitations period during the pendency of a federal action. Now, in that case, this court found that because the limitations period did not prevent the plaintiff from commencing the state law action in the correct state court, the tolling provisions of 25-201.01 just did not apply. And Brodeen is exactly on point with this case. Mr. Saylor's state law claims were filed in the incorrect court. And to clarify, the claims that Mr. Saylor filed in federal court included both state law claims of negligence as well as federal law claims via 1983. Now, very shortly after this was filed, I believe in 2013, the district court dismissed the state law claims for lack of subject matter jurisdiction because the only place of jurisdiction for an original action for state law claims is in the district court here in Nebraska. So by the end of 2013, although the federal claims still remained in the federal action, the state claims were already knocked out. And at that very moment, at the end of 2013, Mr. Saylor could have filed those actions in state court, but he didn't. If there are no further questions, I request... Yes?
Is this statute and the case upon which you rely were not raised in briefing?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And so your opponent has, and it's not been discussed at any point in the lawsuit, either below or here up to this point?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So your opponent has not had the opportunity to respond to this argument in any way?
I did provide the case and statute to Mr. Wilson earlier this morning, Your Honor.
Okay.
Again, it was discovered after further
research.
So he's
got a couple of minutes to do it, is your
just a few, Your Honor, but yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time is left, please?
5 minutes and 17 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Henry Weidrich. I'm with the law firm Klein Williams, and I represent Correct Care Solutions in this case, which I'll refer to as CCS. I have a few minutes of argument prepared for this morning, but really it can be summed up pretty quickly, and that is that timing matters, especially in this case. And if I may, I'd like to discuss some of the timing issues that I think are pertinent to the court's decision. First, pursuant to Nebraska Statute 25-517, the district court entered an order dismissing CCS from this case on December 6, 2017, for failure to serve within the six-month window. At the time the order was entered, there were no proofs of service on file for CCS. Thus, based on the record before the court had no reason to believe that CCS had been served within the six-month timeline. Therefore, there can be no error based on that order for such dismissal based on the record before the court. Now, Mr. Saylor could present proper supplemental evidence to the court about service and ask the court to reconsider. The court would then be required to reconsider. Appellant now claims in their briefing that this order was an error simply because it was premature, that under Nebraska Statute 25-507.01, which governs the timeline to file proofs of service when service is accomplished by certified mail, that they had 10 days after they received the proof of service back to file it, and that therefore they say that the court's order is premature. But the statute that they cite for that purpose doesn't compel the district court to wait. In fact, the way that the statute is written, the court's not going to know when that timeline passes, because it isn't 10 days in the briefing they talked about, we have 10 days from November 30th, which was the deadline to serve. It's 10 days from when they received the receipt back, or there was electronic notice that they could look at. Service occurred here on November 27th, 2017, within the deadline. That's not disputed. They filed the proofs of service December 8th. That's 12 days after service, and that was potentially that they didn't even comply with 507.01, depending on when they got the service back. But it didn't really matter because the same statute says failure to file these proofs of service doesn't negate timely service. So if the court had waited to see if, hey, let me give them more time to see if they filed proofs of service, it may not know if it's met the timelines. And even if they didn't meet those timelines, they could come back and say, court, I'm sorry, but I didn't file these, but we did accomplish service.
Is that what they tried to do with the motion to alter or amend?
They did try to on the motion to alter or amend. And this is where the timing, though, is so important.
That was the purpose of that, is that correct?
That's absolutely the purpose of that, John.
But by that point, it's removed to federal court.
That's right. And we're talking hours on the same day. So dismissed on December 6th, Mr. Saylor filed, there's a removal filed at about noon on December 8th. Later that afternoon, Mr. Saylor filed a motion to alter or amend. And that's where there was some confusion on the record about a hearing that followed, where Mr. Saylor's counsel didn't appear for. The court denied that order. Then there was another order, another motion to alter amend filed in January by Mr. Saylor in the state court, even though there was still no jurisdiction. It was still removed. That was again denied. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Saylor never asked for the relief that he wanted on the service issue while the court had jurisdiction. Once it was finally remanded in April, even though he had filed these two previous motions which were denied, filed a motion in federal court to alter amend based on service, once it got remanded in April, at the end of April, they never asked for that relief again. And so if you want protection from the court, my position would be that if you're in the position to protect yourself, you must do so. In addition to that, after it was remanded, they asked the leave of court to file an amended complaint, which it did, which he did. Included all the same defendants, all the doctors, including CCS, in the amended complaint. Again, never requested a summons, didn't accomplish service. To the extent that they were harmed by the dismissal, the previous dismissal, which they thought was errant, they were given relief and chance to serve CCS, who were defendants in the lawsuit. They didn't take that action. The case was eventually granted, well, the state was granted summary judgment, I think a month or 6 weeks later, but never moved to add CCS back to the case. And now we're sitting 29 months since the complaint was filed. CCS has had no substantive involvement in the case, not to their, on any error that they committed.
Were you present, was CCS present and represented in front of the district court on more than one occasion?
Yes, Your Honor.
And on which occasions was CCS present in front of the district court on this matter?
I know CCS was appeared on the first motion to alter amend that was filed on December 8th. I think the hearing was sometime in January. I don't know for sure the date.
Is that waiving service?
I think we withheld our objection on the service issue. I wasn't a counsel at the time, Your Honor, but I believe that was the case.
And when was the other time?
The second motion to alter amend was filed in January. It was noticed for hearing in March. I think the hearing was March 2nd, 2018, two months before remand. But I believe the same objection was that we preserved that same objection on service.
And was CCS present in the district court in 2018 when after the matter was remanded back and the motion to dismiss was filed and then converted to a motion for summary judgment?
I do not believe so, Your Honor, but I'm not 100% certain on that. That's my time. If there's no further questions, I really appreciate the opportunity this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. You're excused. We have some time.
Yes, Your Honor. 2 minutes.
Mr. Wilson, thanks.
So, Your Honor, just to confirm, counsel did approach me with the statute and the case right when I arrived here today, and I thanked him for that. We haven't briefed that argument. We haven't discussed it yet, that whether 81-8227, subsection 5, essentially negates our entire argument here. What I would suggest is that to the extent that 82-275 purports to limit the ability to raise the savings clause, those two statutes are going to have to be harmonized in some way. And if this court desires further briefing on the issue, I'm sure it will order it. At this point...
Should the court be reading this as a request by you and or opposing counsels to brief this issue?
I am not making that request at this time. As I said, I know the court can make that determination on its own and order that on its own without the motion of the parties. I'd defer to the state probably in determining whether they want to make that motion. I will research it myself, I guess, and determine whether I want to make that motion for further briefing. But
rather than exit in ambiguity here, let's hear from the state.
Your Honor, I believe the state of the statute is very clear, and I do not believe that there is a speaker. But again,
Your Honor, in the interest of being thorough and this being, an important matter, as all matters before this court are, I'm happy to revisit it and file a supplemental brief.
Oh, okay. I think we'll leave it there, and the court will apply its judgment to this issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you.